This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Throughout my life, the Ten Rings gave our family power.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the second most recent Marvel outing. Wow, they've really packed in these films now that coronavirus has gone away magically, haven't they?
Well, it's over now, yeah.
The second most recent Marvel film, Shang-Chi. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into some of the mythical Chinese organisms that this movie brings up, and what may have led to some of their more superfluous features. The show will be broken up into a few different segments based on those creatures. We'll have time codes below. Skip ahead to the bits you're looking for, by all means. But before we get started, my name's Sam Perrin. I am an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsick, a disease ecologist at the Ben Gurion University of being stuck in the middle of the fucking desert.
Yes.
And alongside Adam is Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist. Libby tried following Adam into the middle of said fucking desert. And Libby still hasn't come back yet, but she'll be here next week.
I'm sure she's fine. She'll be right.
Yeah. So, news. Adam, do you want to tell people what the fuck I'm talking about?
Yes. So, quick PSA up top. When you go hiking, do what I do and make sure you tell people where you're going and what time they should expect you back. That way they know when to worry.
And also take someone with you.
If possible, take someone with you. I will not pretend like it's just as safe going by yourself, but usually it's fine. But if you go, make sure you go on an actual trail and not a trail that is just somebody decided to make up and put on the All Trails app and you decide to trust it because it's on there. It's got to be real. Newsflash, it was not real. And what was supposed to be a 17.4 kilometer hike turned into a 20 kilometer nightmare with over a kilometer of elevation gain. And I got stuck with my phone about to die and had to have the Israeli rescue services come get me.
God damn. The IRS.
Yes.
They'll bloody get you every time if you're American.
just a helicopter full of handsome Israeli soldiers coming to save me with a warm blanket.
Aww.
It was lovely.
What did the blanket have on it?
It was just gray.
Aww.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of boring. They had like a gray one and a black one. I was like, well, you guys could have tried harder.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, the helmet, yeah. The helmet I got was red and theirs were all black, so that's cool. And then I got blown off my feet by the rotor wash.
The rotor wash?
So the downforce from a helicopter, from the blades.
Oh, right.
Fun fact.
That's what it's called, rotor wash.
When you see that in movies, it is fucking powerful. I was trying to get closer to them when they were dropping two of the soldiers off like a line because they couldn't land where I was. And I was trying to get close to them so they knew exactly where I was. And I had to step over like a ledge and I brought one foot off the ground and got quickly blown off my feet by the rotor wash and like almost landed on my back. Mm. That shit is powerful. I was literally on my hands and knees crawling towards it because I couldn't see and I couldn't stand up.
God damn.
It's powerful.
Yeah. You losing any digits? You keeping all your digits?
Oh yeah, I didn't have frostbite. I was, as I keep telling people, a little hypothermic, but as Dave told me, I was more than mildly hypothermic.
Yeah, 33 degrees Celsius is not a joke. Plus,
it was cold.
What's normal body temperature?
Humans usually operate somewhere between sort of 37 to 38. They work kind of in the same. If memory serves, humans are usually closer to 37.5. So if you're down at 33, that's not okay.
The older penguins know that it's just a matter of time before they call out,
"I'm freezing my nuts off!"
Damn, the cold is making everybody crankier.
So, Shang-Chi. Is that... Adam, that's right. Yeah, Shang-Chi, right?
So the problem with the way that Marvel did this character is... originally, everyone said Shang-Chi. And the Shang is not a sound in Mandarin, so it's Shang. And then Chi, when you write it out in what's called pinyin, and that's how you basically transcribe Mandarin sounds into English letters, or Arabic, the Arabic alphabet, or alphabet to the Arabic alphabet, you would write it with a Q. I. That would be the sound chi. The way they have written is pronounced chur, which is how you say to eat. So Shang can mean like on, like Shanghai means on the sea. So Shang-Chi, or Shang-Chi as it's spelled, is, I think, means on the eating.
Okay.
But
Shang-Chi is what we're going to be going with
today. We're
going
to say Shang-Chi, yes.
And despite the fact that Adam has taken a fair bit of Mandarin, as you can probably tell at this point, Dave and I have not, and we are probably going to fuck up a few of the pronunciations. So apologies in advance.
Yes.
Shang-Chi is the story of Sean.
Very different name.
Yeah, to be fair, they do hang that lampshade. Awkwafina gives him a good old riling for it. And his best friend, played by the aforementioned Awkwafina, kind of, they're doing okay. But they're not quite living up to their potential in the glorious city of San Francisco. The past comes back to bite Shang-Chi in the ass when his father, who is the head of a supposedly nefarious terrorist group, comes to find him. Yeah, because he is essentially after their previously murdered mother, who he can hear calling to him from beyond the grave. And Shang-Chi is kind of forced to decide where he fits in this family, and whether or not he wants to live up to the man his father intended him to be.
Right.
Yeah.
AKA an assassin.
Yeah, and of course, sprinkled onto that is your usual Marvel fantasy. There's realms and creatures and big CGI battles, of course.
Well, I think it's fair to say that it's not the Marvel usual sprinkling. If anything, this movie felt like a completely different movie with a bit of Marvel sprinkling on it.
Yeah.
To me.
And we'll get into that now. So, what did we like about this movie?
I think I really enjoyed the setting. It was really fun hearing Mandarin again. It's been 10 years since I lived in Shanghai, and my Mandarin is very, very rusty. But thankfully, it was enough to kind of help me out a little bit, because the totally legal way that I watched this movie only had subtitles available in Arabic, Russian, no, so Arabic, Danish, or Dutch. So I put on Dutch subtitles and was listening to, and then we had the Mandarin scenes, because there's a lot of this movie spoken in Mandarin. And yeah. So my poor brain was trying to do everything it could to hear the Mandarin I could understand, because it's very bad at this point. I struggle to say that I even speak it anymore. And then with my knowledge of German, trying to read subtitles that are kind of the same as German, but also different enough that it's a problem sometimes. So yeah. I got most of these parts, I think. But that was just a fun little mental exercise for me. But yeah. it was a fun little romp, and I really enjoyed all of the what I felt was a pretty good nod towards Chinese culture in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So I had a big phase at the late 90s, early 2000s, where I loved wuxia films. For people who don't know, wuxia is the combination of kind of martial arts in sort of, you know, mystical worlds. Things like Hero, House of Flying Daggers, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon are probably the three best known examples.
Curse of the Golden Flower.
Yeah. And I was really looking forward to seeing the combination of Marvel and a wuxia film. And I thought they nailed it. I thought they got the aesthetic of both in there, and it merged together really well. The casting was amazing. Michelle Yeoh from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Tony Leung from Hero. Adam and I were saying before this, the only thing they could have done better is have Zhang Shiyi as the mother. Simu Liu was fantastic. Him and Awkwafina really are so good as just these couple of mates who just, you know, just bumming along. There were some really fun jokes too. I didn't feel like this was over-the-top Marvel quippy. I thought, you know, Awkwafina, who I used to not like, I've really warmed to. Ben Kingsley's ape joke.
Oh my god.
Just
that made me so fucking happy. He absolutely stole the movie.
And I really love how much of a loose unit Wong turns out to be in this movie.
Yeah.
It's just
Yeah, I mean, I loved all the same stuff that Sam and Adam talked about. And just building on that, I also really adored the settings for the fight scenes. The fight in the bus is incredible. It's definitely, I would argue, like the best one of the film. But at the same time, the fight on the outside of the building really does bring some like extra stakes to the whole mix. And it just feels fun and dumb and interesting. I enjoyed the story overall, in terms of like the ideas, the characters, and the sort of central theme at the middle of it, or the central conflict, was interesting enough that it kept me going throughout it.
What didn't we like about it?
I feel like this movie, much like the criticism that's levied against The Return of the King, had like two or three different endings that just didn't quite flowed together well enough for it to feel natural to me. The Return of the King has never bothered me, and it's just, it's a long movie, but I don't care because all these things need to be wrapped up. But I feel like the movie could have ended at the end of the second act, and then there were like two or three different endings within the third act as well that just really kind of took away my enjoyment of the movie towards the end.
Yeah. So I wanted to get all that stuff I loved up top to show people I did actually like this movie, but I don't think I've ever loved the first two acts of a movie so much and then disliked the third so much, especially for Marvel films. The first two acts of this movie set up this really good emotional core conflict of the family, of Shang-Chi, his sister, and his father, and that conflict that's happening there. And I love that. And I thought that's was going to be what the movie built up to. And then the third act happens and the full-on like Marvel film kicks in. And it really reminded me of Doctor Strange and Black Panther in that a really good... Black Panther in the sense that a really good emotional story kind of got overshadowed a little bit by a big CGI brouhaha.
A rubbery CGI fight.
Yeah. And I don't think this was as rubbery as Black Panther, but I also think Black Panther did enough within the film that it didn't feel like that overshadowed the entire thing. Whereas with this one, I lost the whole conflict between Shang-Chi and his father because of this stupid fucking dragon fight.
Yeah.
I thought they were building up an amazing villain and then they just tossed him away for a completely replaceable CGI villain at the end.
They were introduced to in the very end of it.
Yeah, the start of the third act is when we find out who this random villain is, and I hated that because it was just building up to be such a fantastic movie, and then...
Also, what happened to his sister?
Yeah.
She just got completely sidelined after this. She's such a badass. They established her as such a great character, if not potentially a better fighter than him, too. Like, give her something. Come on.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you on the emotional payoff. At the end, I mean, there really isn't a clear resolution that we were building to, and the conflict is interesting enough. The dad wanting to try and rescue the mom while also simultaneously separating him from his kids. That's a realistic human's experience, these types of change and shifts and crappiness all the time. I also really just hated, and I hate the trope of the bad guys will work together with the good guys at a drop of the hat at the end, where they're just like, oh yeah, no, these things are coming. We all need to work together and we'll be friends now. Fuck you. There is a whole bunch of people who don't get up when that, like, they make that point.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh yeah, we should totally work together. Let those people go. And they let like two people go, but there's a lot of the natural inhabitants of this world that stay down. And I'm like, no, like if you're like, oh no, I just stabbed Adam, but we fight together now. I'm going to be like, you were going to fight 10 feet away from me and you're going to fight without any of the equipment that you can use against the demon. Fuck you.
I'd be trying to kill you because the last time we met, I tried to kill you.
Trivia. This is my second favorite bit of trivia ever, by the way. I just want a bit of sizzle, build up to this. But so this is, like I said, considered a Wuxia film, but it's not the highest grossing American made Wuxia film ever. Dave Adam, try and guess what the highest grossing American made Wuxia film is.
American made.
I mean, I love Shang.
Hero is not American made.
Hero is Chinese made.
I
mean, yeah.
I guess the closest I could get would be Crouching, but Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is not.
That's also Chinese made.
Okay. Also Chinese. And I think that House of Flying Daggers was as well. It can't be Shaolin Soccer, can it?
No, no, it's not Shaolin Soccer. It's also not Bulletproof Monk.
I was hoping it was Kung Fu Hustle, but I think that's also not American made.
That's Chinese made, yeah.
I don't know.
Can I say it?
Yeah.
Kung Fu Panda 2!
Really?
Yeah! It is considered a Wuxia film.
I never would have thought those were Wuxia, but it makes sense.
Yeah, it's everything you need in a Wuxia film. It was considered a Wuxia film when it came out in China. And from what I've read, I mean, I haven't asked China. We haven't been in touch lately. But apparently it was very well received over there. So yeah, it really makes me happy that that's the highest grossing American-made Wuxia film ever. Second is Kung Fu Panda 1. So,
as we've mentioned on this podcast before, this is what Sam continues to believe is the ultimate trilogy. And I remember meeting you first when you like moved in. You're like, you've never seen these movies. We need to sit down and watch them or we can't continue being friends.
Yeah.
Finally, a worthy opponent. Our battle will be legendary.
Right, so before we get in, before we start looking at some of the animals that were brought up in this movie, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, please visit the website, cinematicanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat again with us on Discord. Just type in Cinematica Animalia and you'll find us. If you want to read the absent Libby's work, The Baroness in Absentia, visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and you can sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about some of the less movie-related ecology that Adam, myself, and a massive international team write about, you can visit ecologyforthemasses.com. So, we mentioned before that the third act of this film is a rapid departure from the first two acts, and that's because they find themselves in this mystical village called Tarlo. Tarlo is part of kind of another realm, or
seems to be another dimension.
Yeah, that is inhabited by tons of creatures that are pulled pretty much straight from Chinese folklore, which is really cool. Like the I think I said this last week, the interpretations of them from the page or from ancient, you know, Chinese scrolls or paintings to the movie is, I've never seen anything more direct.
It's basically a carbon copy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's fantastic. I think that that's, you know, really well done. And so what we're going to do now is just go through some of these and talk about why they're so wrong. not from a Chinese folklore point of view, of course, but from like just purely a biological point of view.
Where is its face?
Well, let's start there. The Hundun. That's the first thing we're introduced to. It's a little kind of furry butt monster.
What did he name it? Gary?
Morris.
Yeah. Gary. Trevor Slattery introduces at one point. I loved his cameo, by the way. I thought that was actually really well integrated.
It's his mate.
And this is the... just such a fucking dork of an animal. So it's got kind of four main legs and then two little ones that are kind of... they look a little vestigial in between.
Did they? Okay, I didn't notice that they were smaller.
Yeah, I think they were. I'm not 100% sure.
The wings are absolutely vestigial.
Yeah.
Yeah, so some useless fucking wings. But they look really cool. They kind of act like moth wings at some point, the way it's signaling to another... they look like moth antenna at some point, the way they signal to each other with
them. Yeah, I had a theory about those.
Yeah. I found a quote... from Chinese folklore that I pulled straight off Wikipedia for full disclosure about these creatures goes as such. There is a god here who looks like a yellow sack. He is scarlet like cinnabar fire. He has 6 feet and 4 wings. He is muddle thick. He has no face and no eyes. He knows how to sing and dance. He is in truth the great god Long River. Now, at no point looking at this Hundun did I think, yeah, that's a god. I'd worship that. It looked like a burrowing creature, if you forget about the wings. It looks like a wombat in many senses. Like, the
without
build... Yeah, a wombat without a face, yeah. And if it's a burrowing creature, then, you know, potentially reduced vision would help out.
But then it would need...
wouldn't help out, but would save energy. It wouldn't need so much vision. And I maintain that there is a mouth under there somewhere.
There's a mouth and there's like probably small, very like photosensitive eyes, much like a mole. So they're not super well developed. They're used mostly a sense of smell and touch to get around.
Yeah. That's what I was kind of thinking. The senses of a mole or, something along those lines, a naked mole rat, that sort of thing, where they have very reduced senses because they don't need them because they spend so much of their time underground. Now, in truth, a lot of creatures that burrow all the time live entirely fossorial lifestyles. Fossorial?
Yeah, fossorial.
Yeah, fossorial, meaning to burrow, yeah. They are generally much smaller because it's hard to be constantly, making your way.
Which is where the wings become a huge problem.
Right, they would have a completely different body plan. They wouldn't be stubby. Our burrowing breeds tend to have big, long claws to scrape and dig with, and then they tend to have a much more narrow body plan.
Yeah.
I feel like this is some kind of really interesting conflict between sexual selection and natural selection, where the environment they're living in is going to be selecting for a more streamlined, robust, thickly muscled, big clawed animal that can burrow really well. But my guess about these wings is there's some kind of sexually selected trait where it's potentially a identifying feature for a species or a subspecies within this genus. Or it's a matter of females and males picking each other based off the quality of their wings, if they even have a binary sexual system.
But this is the thing, that doesn't suit very well with a species that can't see.
No, but maybe it's a case where it's something in either the infrared or the ultraviolet, and our eyes can't see it, but maybe they have some kind of special, they can see in a different wavelength than we can.
Yeah. See, I was going with the, in the sense that they're used as kind of like moth antenna at the start of Act 3, I was thinking that maybe they are some sort of feeler or antenna that they help navigate the way around tunnels with. I think that they've started off as feelers, and they've just been they've been domesticated. These things have been domesticated, and humans have bred selectively for larger and larger antenna to the point that is probably, not great for the hunduns.
That's my guess for the fox.
Completely agree with you. I mean, none of these animals are attacking each other. None of these animals are eating one another, and we'll definitely get into this as this goes. But yeah, the domestication idea of just a group of humans who came in and has drastically altered the surrounding wildlife and been like, you're dependent on us. You live in this area now and you follow our rules, fits very well with all of the creatures we're going to talk about.
Yeah. And I mean, let's jump straight to the foxes, Adam mentioned. So we talked about this kind of earlier in the season when we did Princess Monocle. What's the actual name?
Princess Mononoke.
Yeah. Sorry, I keep looking at that fucking Google Drive that's still called Printer's Monocle. We talked about the kitsune, which are the Japanese shapeshifters who often take the shape of a multi-tailed wolf. This is the...
Fox.
Hulijing.
Multi-tailed fox, yeah. So this is the Chinese version, which is called a Hulijing.
Hulijing, yeah.
Okay.
So you see that? Looks exactly like Ninetales from Pokemon. Yeah, it's the Chinese parallel or analog of their kitsune. You can see, I don't know, I might be misinterpreting this, but we can actually see the young fox split from having one tail into three? Or does it always have three and I'm just not viewing it?
I think it always had three.
I think they're holding them together.
Okay. Yeah. We talked about this briefly in the Princess Mononoke episode. That's generally not a thing for mammals at all, but it can happen in some reptiles. For instance, when a tail gets released voluntarily when it's being attacked, they can regrow two tails. It's generally a mistake. It's not something that's supposed to happen, but it can happen. So I think what's probably gone on is that you've had a similar situation where you've got a mammal that can potentially let go of its tail. Doesn't work that well because it looks like a predator. And humans have just, constantly bred for this or, and this could be even worse, selectively pulled their tails off at different points in their lives.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fucking horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's more that there was just one born that had this freak mutation of having maybe an extra tail, and they've just been really selected for that and pushed for it hard and bred for it.
Because we,
and in fairness, if it's a domestic creature, then the extra energy costs associated with growing those extra tails would probably be met by the fact that it's domesticated and fed on a regular basis, right, Dave?
Yeah. Right?
So, yeah.
And they both seem to be like bright white, which is not a color you see very often in nature outside of an Arctic habitat.
Yeah, there's no reason for these to be white at all. I guess I'd be interested to see if that happens, if you can just breed selectively over, hundreds of years for Arctic foxes that keep their white fur for longer.
You definitely could. You 100% could.
Yeah. Because it's not something an Arctic fox wants to do, otherwise it will just be seen automatically by its prey constantly.
No.
It's actually a real problem with climate change, bringing winter to an end earlier and to a start later, is that a lot of some species aren't able to keep up with these changing dates. And so they're turning white or turning back into their grey browns at the wrong time. And prey species are just like, yep, gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, most dog colors are artificial in terms of the changes and shifts that we see. Most horse colors are as well. It's very reasonable for a group of people to say like, we want that coat. That looks nice with my house, and breed for it.
Yeah.
You're this color now.
Yeah. And while we're on colors, the next thing we should talk about is the Keelin, which is basically a horse, but it can't be a horse because it's green. And I think we talked about this a couple of weeks back. Mammals are actually not capable of producing green fur, which I find fascinating. Yeah. There's a couple of reasons for this. One is because they just something to do with the way we process chlorophyll. And the fact that we can't convert that into a color in our hair or in our fur, it goes into a lot of chemistry, which was by far my weakest subject at school. So I don't want to, you know,
same,
piss off any burgeoning or experienced chemists on this podcast. So I'll stay away from that.
Tide goes in, yeah. Tide goes out. You can't explain that.
What about the moon, Adam? Oh, who put the moon there? Huh? You can't explain that.
It's made of cheese.
Fuck, I hate that guy, yeah. But the other thing is, which I think is really cool, is that there's actually not much call for green fur in nature. No. Because a lot of species that mammals prey on are other mammals, and a lot of mammals are colorblind. So, for instance, the reason tigers are striped orange is because most of the mammals that they prey on can't tell the difference between orange and green.
They're red and colorblind.
Yeah, they're red-green colorblind. So, they can't see a tiger because to them, the tiger is green. So, yeah, for a lot of mammals, there's just the predators. There's not much point in turning green. There's no real point in having green in your fur. So, yeah.
And if people think of these examples as far as sloths having some green, it's because they have freaking moss growing on their bodies because of how fucking slowly they live.
They got a lichen population.
Yeah. There are also some species of possum and some species of monkey that the way that kind of brown combines with white or gray in their fur, it looks like a kind of a drab olive color, but it's not really green at all. Yeah. But aside from that, there is nothing spectacular about these creatures at all. Apart from the fact that I was really expecting it to speak when it stopped and looked at them. I was like, okay, good. I'm not the only one.
It's either going to be some sage moments.
Yeah. You should turn around while you still have the chance, young man, or some shit like that.
It's dangerous to go alone. Take this. Hands him a smaller horse.
Yeah. Or a hundun. Just piffs another hundun into the car. That's how Tony Leung got it in the first place.
Exactly.
But yeah, there's nothing that really spectacular about this. The antlers look like an ibex. Ibex are a springbok's antlers. Oh, sorry. Ibex have horns. But they're branched like a moose's or roe deer's antlers, but they have kind of the twisting to them like some ibex horns have. The hooves, I mean, even in reptiles, we've had hoof-like appendages on reptiles before. Mm. That's not really too much of a problem. And the whole body is just like a, I don't know, some sort of rhinoceros ungulate relative.
But it's covered in scales.
Yeah, the scales are a problem.
If they're, in fact, real scales, and they're not just something else that's evolved to look like scales in terms of a more traditional plating or keratin structure.
Yeah, pangolins, right?
Exactly. I mean, I don't have any problem with that.
Keratinized?
Yeah, exactly, in terms of with some other shift or change. Again, not something we would expect to see in nature with that conformation, with that standing up in that position and those combination of different features. But if you're in a situation where you're breeding for them and you're like, I want a scaled horsey. Yeah.
Yeah. Dave, do you think their movement, like the speed at which they were running, was okay for being that size?
Yeah.
For a species.
I didn't have any concerns with, like, I mean, they just look like weird looking horses, although I can't.
Okapi. Look up okapi, Dave. O-K-A-P-I.
O-K-A-P-I.
It's a relative of the giraffe.
They don't have scales, do they?
No, they don't, but I just mean the basic body plan.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly the same, pretty much, like neck length and all that sort of
thing. Yeah, I mean, I don't have any concerns with their general physical structure. It's just the combination of things. I was like, oh, that's unusual. I don't imagine that you're going to spend a lot of time in the water, although swimming with horses is a very cool experience. I am not the biggest fan of horses at all times, but if you can swim with them, it's absolutely awesome.
Why?
It just used to be I went horseback riding for years and years and years. So as much as I make fun of horses, I do it from a position of I used to be horse person.
Okay.
It was my favorite thing. If like at the end you would go and we had this big watering hole, you'd take the saddle off, all the gear, and you just climb into the water. And you had these giant creatures that were like swimming next to you in the water. And I feel humans have these moments where we wrap ourselves around the idea that we're big and we're powerful and we're gigantic. And you find yourself swimming in this water and suddenly there's this enormous creature swimming next to you that you're like, you could push me under the water and drown me. And they're like, fuck off, little creature. I'm hot.
Yeah, I've heard people have similar experiences when they swim with whales and like looking in the whale's eyes and it just like changes their lives.
I think being reminded we ain't shit is a nice feeling. I would way rather tell the truth. I ain't shit.
Whoa, nah, nah, baby, I ain't shit. Before we let Dave take over and explain why all this sort of stuff is actually kind of horrible, we should talk about the dragons.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to the Great Protractor...
Great Protector?
The Great Protractor. Just people who really like geometry class, yeah. Now, when it comes to the Great Protector, apart from the flying and the size, two big things, two big aspects of it, admittedly, I don't really have any problem with East Asian dragons in general. Like, it's the same sort of body plan as an otter,
yeah.
But more elongated. The lifestyle makes sense. The jaws make sense. There's nothing really that I have an issue with.
Their scales make sense.
Yeah. The scales there absolutely make sense. Yeah. And, the vestigial legs even, like, if this is a creature that's still spending a little bit of time on land and kind of like a transitionary species between, you know, one that's permanently, on land and one that's permanently in the water or vice versa, then yeah, I mean, don't have too many problems with this, right? Adam, is there anything you can think of that looks a bit silly?
My only thought is this looks like an anaconda and a crocodile had a baby, and I'm here for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. there is one thing I do want to point out. Now, obviously, it can't fly, but there are snakes that can glide in a certain
frogs
amount.
Too.
Yeah, there's a genus of snake that is called Chrysopelea. Don't know exactly how to spell it, but they are arboreal snakes, so they spend almost all of their time in the trees, from around Southeast Asia. And what they do is they will go to the end of a branch, kind of form a J shape, launch themselves to the nearest tree, and kind of undulate in the air, not dissimilar to what the dragon does in this movie, in an effort to kind of glide from tree to tree.
That's so cool.
It's generally a way to escape from predators, not so much to catch prey. But it is really cool to watch, and I recommend looking them up on YouTube. You can just type in flying snakes, and you'll find it.
I also feel this is a giant fuck you to every professor that ever got mad about a video with a guy trying to, like, run when he's in the air.
Yeah.
And I feel like you can, like, point at the snake and be like, they are. They're running, and it works. Yeah.
But I like the movement of it, the way that it looks like it's just moving through water the whole time.
Yeah, all is sinusoidal movement, side to side, not quite up and down.
And then, of course, there's the Dweller in the Darkness, which is, I don't know, for me, this is the exact same problem we had with a couple of monsters in the last couple of years, with Aquaman's Kraken.
With Julie Andrews.
Yeah, with Julie Andrews. Just too many fucking segments and tails and bits.
Why does he have tentacles and arms and wings?
Yeah, and like tentacles on tentacles and all that sort of shit.
Four,
like,
tails.
And then six pairs of arms and shit. Like, it just, it's so much. There's so much going on. It reminds me of the things from the Tomorrow War. It's just segments everywhere.
Yeah.
Biofluorescence when it's eating doesn't make sense. Whenever it's like sucking up souls, it completely changes color. And you're like, so you want things to know when you're exposed and you're eating? Cool.
Yeah.
Making other organisms biofluoresce as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was anybody else thinking when, you know, the Dweller in Darkness is trying to consume the soul of the Great Protector? Was anybody else just having, like, Kerry Takanaga's head in their mind going, your soul is mine?
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Kerry Tagawa. Kerry Tagawa's voice.
I was going to say, my partner had asked me last night when I was, like, writing this all up, and she's like, so how are you going to make the whole soul-eating thing work? And I'm like, the closest I could get that would leave a shell behind would be the idea that these creatures come down, they cocoon the humans, they inject their digestive juices into them, and then they suck them back out via a straw and then run off with all of that juice. And it's like, oh, they sucked their essence and they leave behind the body. And I'm like, but it would take a really long time and it would be awkward if everybody else is waiting around while that's going on.
Yeah,
don't mind me.
Maybe they
find some organs here.
Yeah, maybe they got an English translation mixed up somewhere there, and they just really like the undersides of humans' feet.
Yeah,
they are consuming our souls. You mean your soul, like singular, right? No, both of them. I can't wear clogs anymore.
Jesus, yeah.
I'm sure they were all wearing clogs beforehand.
That traditional Chinese shoe.
Yeah. Okay, but So we've gone over why all of these creatures, with the potential exception of the Great Protector, have things that just make absolutely no sense and would potentially be deleterious, which is a fancy way of saying bad, for their lives. Like, you know, just not having a face and having these enormous wings when you're a burrowing animal, not great for you. Having nine tails doesn't really make much sense. Being too big. That's the only problem I have with the lions. Again, I didn't want to go into it. They're just too big. But we have bred for bigger species before. Yeah. I mean, a liger is a combination of a tiger and a lion, and it's bigger than both. Like, those things are massive. Yes. But, as we mentioned, domestication sounds, you know, fun and is a potential solution to this, but we've done some horrible things to animals.
Yeah. And, I mean, kind of as we've talked about before, the original sort of domestication of, and I'm just going to do dogs here because there's more than enough horrific stuff in the dog category. So, I mean, as we've discussed before on this podcast, the actual domestication of dog, and we're just going to do dogs here because there's more than enough horrific shit in this category. I mean,
you like dogs,
cows, horses.
I like,
there's dogs. Lots there, but yeah. Approximately, let's say 15,000 years ago, although we talked about the gap points that take place, there's still a big debate about when exactly we domesticated dogs. There is less.
And if we did it on more than one occasion.
There is far less debate when it comes to the creation of dog breeds, which is really where things start to get messed up. So it was approximately 200 to 150 years ago that almost all of dog breeds were created. And it was generated during what is known as the Victorian Explosion. During this time in Great Britain, dog breeding intensified and expanded, resulting in many of the current recognizable dog breeds. Heavily influenced by the ideas of Darwin, local British aristocrats became passionate about breeding for the idea of creating the ideal or specific breed. I usually summarize this whenever I talk to owners as a bunch of bored British dudes before the invention of Netflix, sitting around and being like, we shall make the dog fuck until it is orange. And the process of all of the pure breeds, and I'm sure I would catch flack at work because they are all artificial and this is all bullshit. Literally just being, you have a dog, you're like, I really like this color. I'm going to have it make puppies. It makes puppies. And you're like, but I want more dogs with this specific color. And then you start the nasty inbreeding cycle of parent to child, child to parent, and basically limiting the gene pool down in really horrific ways.
Adam, what's the inbreeding coefficient if you have a child, if you have a child with your sibling?
If you have a child with your sibling, the inbreeding coefficient is, that's a good question.
It's 0.25. That's the inbreeding coefficient of having a child with your sibling. The inbreeding coefficient of the Bernese Mountain Dog is 0.35 these days.
Yeah. And we continue to only want to breed these breeds. So the idea is it's still going on. Just because you're like, well, I bred a Berner with a Berner from a different household. Like, their genetic diversity is still not there. You are still continuing that to this day. There are potentially 400 recognizable dog breeds, and it has created some horrific shit. Because if you're breeding for, you want that dog to look orange, or you want that dog to have stubby little legs, you're not caring about the other genetic factors. And this becomes a huge problem. One of my favorite neurologists used to regularly say, he's like, if people started responsibly breeding, 90% of veterinary surgical procedures would be out of business within 20 years. Like, it's just so much of what we treat is genetic problems currently. And so I'm going to focus on a couple of ones that are just sort of general, and then I'm going to go into some more details on some truly horrifying shit. So, corkscrew tails, this can be a common bulldog and French bulldog position, where basically the tail is generated in such a way that it grows back and can basically ingrow into the surrounding tissue. It's a true vertebral malformation. The best story that I have with this case is they're really difficult to repair. A veterinary surgeon is required. In really severe cases, they have to go in and basically pull out those individual spinal segments and try to reset them and realign them in such a way that it's not going to cause any more problems or tissue. And I've never had to do one of these, but one of the professors who taught me said they're really difficult. One of the most difficult procedures he's had to do. And when he first started his career as a surgeon, they had someone bring in their bulldog and he repaired it. And he said it was an awful procedure. Like, he got everything done, but it just absolutely killed him. And he gets up the next day and comes into work, and he's got another consult for one, like, booked on his schedule. And he's like, what the fuck? And he sits down and he like pulls up a website and he finds out that the person who he did the corkscrew tail on, the breeder, was so happy with the work that he'd done that they put him on a list of recognizable surgeons to do these repairs. And he realized that if he let this fly, he was going to spend the rest of his career just repairing corkscrew tail after corkscrew tail. And he ended up calling the breeder and he's like, take me off that list now.
Yeah.
Now, we get all kinds of other problems that take place. Small breed dogs are very prevalent with patellar luxations. That's the idea that their kneecap doesn't actually fit inside the groove. And so on a regular basis, as they're walking, the kneecap actually pops out onto the internal aspect of their leg and then pops back in, creating continuous lameness. It has to be surgically corrected. Pug eyes have those giant eyes. We think they're super cute. They get corneal abrasions all the time. They run into things all the time and need medications and maintenance and oftentimes surgical procedures to repair the damage. The other sort of common, we run into cranial cruciate ligament ruptures. Humans think of this as their ACL. And usually for a human to break their ACL, you have to be like hit by a car or have a football accident or do something of that nature. It's the ligament that holds.
Or just step wrong.
Yeah.
But for dogs, they can just snap these if it's genetically weakened. And again, requires a surgical procedure. Now, the most horrifying ones that we're going to get into right now, because this is where shit gets real. So, Dachshunds. We talked about this at the beginning. Super cute, lovely wiener dog. They are adorable, but they are incredibly overrepresented in our categories for intervertebral disc herniations. So your discs are the little cushions that basically sit in between your spinal cord. They're great. They're wonderful. They allow you to jump up and down and all do these things. When you stretch out their back like that, then in situations where even the smallest amount of force is applied because of genetic weaknesses that are present in the disc can be propulsed up into their spinal cord, press against their spinal cord, and they lose the ability to walk in their back legs. They need a surgical procedure to go in and remove that material and remove pressure. It's expensive. And the current stats are suggesting that at least 25% of these dogs will have at least one episode of the type 1 Hansen. That's the type of the intervertebral disc disease at least one time in their life. We see multiple dogs for repeat occurrences.
That's horrible.
Yeah. Bulldogs. Cute, lovely, big, wonderful. Every bulldog you have ever petted is almost guaranteed to have been born via C-section. They can't physically give birth. They're just too big in terms of their presentation. It can happen sometimes. We usually recommend it, meaning when breeders have a bulldog, they have to come in and see us and plan a date for the dog's C-section. We're putting them through a surgical procedure to go through something like birth. And as much as we're like, oh, C-sections aren't that big a deal, most women would disagree. As well, if you've ever thought of it, most of them can't actually conceive naturally. Their hips are too big, and the way that their weight shifts, that it's almost impossible for them to naturally conceive. So when they try to line up, since the dog is so much heavier in the front than they are in the back, when they mount and their weight basically pushes down on the back end of the female, it makes it almost impossible for them to tie. 80 to 90% of all bulldogs are brought about via artificial insemination. So we're keeping a breed up that can't actually naturally either start reproduction or actually give birth.
Pandas. Sorry.
How much of a difference does it make if you've got two, just say you've got two of these breeds, right, with massive problems, and you put them together?
That's the problem. We're in this world right now where we're kind of stuck because we've started to combine these. Doodles are a perfect example, and I love doodles, don't get me wrong, but you're taking very inbred dogs and you're breeding them together, and all we're seeing is the problems from both breeds represented. And people breed for appearance. Breeders have bred for a very long time for appearance because that's the first thing that humans see. They see a cute dog that they like the look of. And as a result, we're ignoring these underlying genetic traits that don't pop up until later down the line. because you can't see them. They're not obvious from the outside, or owners aren't aware that these could be an issue. And it always comes up of like, well, no. My breeder said that, like, you know, we've got a warranty. Your warranty is usually if something goes wrong with the puppy, you can just bring it back and switch it out for another one. And that's not what most pet owners want. We get attached to our living creatures. Dogs are awesome.
Yeah.
Now, the last two that I'm going to talk about, because they do get horrifying. So hip dysplasia. Dysplasia is a fancy word for doesn't work properly. Our hips, dogs' hips as well, are in a situation where they have a ball joint that's associated, and basically it goes into what's called the acetabulum attached to the hip, and that's what allows the leg to swing. In cases of hip dysplasia, okay, that ball joint is eroded such that there's not anything for the ball to actually join into. The hip has improperly formed. And so as a result, every time the dog walks, that ball basically just drags itself back and forth on the bones of the hip.
Oh.
Again, we need a surgical procedure, either a total hip. Young dogs end up doing a total hip replacement, like a human that's had that type of condition. Or we end up actually having to excise the femoral head. Now, this is becoming less common because it's something that breeders can check with right off the bat. They can take a young puppy, or they can take the parents and do x-rays and confirm that the animals they're selling actually have good hip integrity, which is good. But we are starting to see a little bit more of a recurrence during COVID breeding practices when everybody's breeding, because puppies are worth so much right now. Now,
I hate that so fucking much.
The last one to talk about, because in my opinion, this is the one that stands out the most. And this is the one that we can do the most about, because France has already started fixing this problem. And there is a movement right now in North America, as well as Europe, that we would like to try and stick onto. So brachiocephalic obstructive airway syndrome, or BOS. So a brachiocephalic face is a pug, a bulldog. It's the idea that the face looks like it's pushed in, because it is.
And if you think that looks cute, Google brachiocephalic horse and see how fucked up it looks on literally any other species that we're not used to seeing.
So we've pushed their face in over generations. The problem is, the reason dogs have a long, normal-sized nose is because there's a lot of structures that are inside of that. And when you start to push that in, it creates changes. They get shrunken noses, enlarged tongues, the soft palate. If you take your tongue and you touch it against the top of your mouth, you'll feel a soft structure there. So if you push the face in, all of that stuff has to go somewhere. And oftentimes they find themselves, the equivalent is to spending their days breathing through a straw. One of the most heartbreaking moments from a veterinary perspective is that when we do surgeries, like in humans, you place a tube down their throat that basically goes into the trachea, the structure that connects their mouth to their lungs, so that we can maintain the airway. There's no risk that if they vomit, they're going to pull it into their lungs. And with brachiocephalic dogs, when they wake up, so pugs, bulldogs, whatever it is, we don't pull the tube out right away. Most normal dogs, they wake up and they immediately start chomping on the tube because it's in their mouth, it's obstructing, it's causing bothersome concern. You want to get it out as quick as possible. With brachiocephalics, we leave it in. And they can actually stand up, and I will admit they are sometimes at their happiest they've ever been. Because for the first time in their life, they're not breathing through a straw. There's nothing obstructing their airway. They will walk around completely awake with these tubes in, and you get this heartbreaking moment when you deflate the tube and pull it out in these dogs, where they go back to breathing the way that they normally do, and they just look up at you like, oh, I'm back to this again.
That is horrendous.
France has started breeding pugs responsibly. There's a bunch of different groups that have started choosing, like, hey, this animal is not at a state where it breathes properly, or this is a serious issue. And responsible breeding has become one of the biggest pushes in veterinary medicine as we go forward. We love our canine companions. I blame no owner that takes possession of one of these dogs and gets stuck with all the financial bills of trying to keep their friend comfortable and happy. But if we put enough pressure on organizations like kennel clubs to say, like, your breed standards of, oh, well, it must look like this because it is the way it was. It's only been 200 years. Yeah. Fuck off. That's not a legacy. That's not a dynasty. That is basically just two generations.
Yeah. And even, like, if you look at 100 years ago, what a lot of these breeds looked like, they looked a lot more, well, normal dog-like.
Yeah.
That looks healthier.
Yeah, I mean, even German Shepherds, that whole sloping kind of posture from front to tail, that was a lot less inclined, even 100 years ago. So, annoys me that in Norway, everybody is so, because I've said this before, everyone's so obsessed with pure breeding here. But they consider de-sexing and neutering an animal, animal cruelty. And for me, pure breeding has always been a form of animal cruelty, really, for most breeds. Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are some breeds of dogs out there that are quite healthy, despite the fact they're purebred, right? Like, mainly farm dogs? Not
really. I mean, there's any...
Really? Okay.
Any dog breed...
I thought, like, cattle dogs, border collies, kelpies, that sort of thing, they were better because they were so interbred.
The problem is, any breed that you've got is going to have magnified genetic problems, because there's a magnified original source. Right, people go, oh, well, German Shepherds. German Shepherds are overrepresented as our highest number associated with problems. Huskies, they have all kinds of immune-mediated disorders. That blue color you love with their eyes, that's concentrated genetic material. You're going to see higher rates. Boxers, higher rates of cancer. Mast cell tumors are fairly common. Any group that we list, they're going to have a higher genetic prevalence because you've concentrated a genetic pool. Instead of having these diseases pop up where it's like, oh, Sam's family had a history of this, and so now it's more common down the line, we're saying every one of these ancestors, it's the equivalent to the royal family in hemophilia. I would not adopt a member of the royal family. If you were like, absolutely not. Are you
God, no. Bunch of horrible old racists. You don't want them in your house.
Inbred racists.
If you brought Charles forward and you're like, Sam, do you feel comfortable taking care of all of his medical bills for the next 20 years? You'd be like, no, 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 don't put that on me.
Sorry to any royalists out there. Right. No, I'm not. I'm not sorry.
Go fuck yourself.
But the good news is we are seeing increased pressure. People are getting less specific about, I have a purebred that exists of this certain type. They are moving away. They are becoming more aware of these types of problems. And they are trying to shift their conceptions of a dog is just a dog at the end of the day. It doesn't have to be a purebred. No. It can just be, you just want a dog.
Long story short, adopt, don't shop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big time. In the arms of the angel, fly
away from here. But did we feel bad for any, I mean, obviously, considering the big rant we've just had about domestication, I think I can guess our answers here, but do we feel bad for any of the quote-unquote monsters in this film?
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. The dogs are going to have joint and back disease. The foxes are going to break those tails on a frequent basis and have problems associated with like keeping them all in line or them getting like tangled up or secondary problems. The poor hundred.
The dog, they all have smashing faces. What you just spent like a couple minutes talking about how bad that is for those airways. Those fucking battle lions can't breathe.
No, you're right. Yeah. They'll have horrible brachiocephalic airway disease. I don't even want to think about what you would make me treat for Morris if you brought that in and you were like, his vestigial wings keep catching and like he's got this tiny little mouth that keeps locking in.
He doesn't actually have a butt.
Right. Where is his butthole? Yeah. Where is his butthole? That would not be fun. I definitely feel bad for these creatures.
Yeah. Would we recommend this movie though?
I would. I think this was, much like Black Panther, Marvel did a really good job of celebrating another part of the world's culture and incorporating it into a movie that really, really works. Is it the best movie ever? No, but it's really fun and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I absolutely recommend this. The characters save it for me. Like I said, that third act really brings this down, but the characters are just... Simu Liu and Awkwafina are so good as the main two, and please don't make them a couple.
Yes.
Oh my god, please don't. Fucking don't.
They're so good as that like friends dynamic. I don't want that to change.
I would definitely recommend this film. I like the idea of the siblings versus the father idea. I thought that was fun in terms of an angle that we'd seen. And I also found their father absolutely terrifying. The scene where he goes in to find the mother's killers and he's just beating everybody to death with the 10 rings. And then walks up to the last guy who's like, I don't know where my boss is. And he's like, I believe you. And just pounds him into the concrete. And then it like cuts back to the sun. And I'm like, yeah, that'd be fucking terrifying. I'd be like, yeah, I'm not fighting that.
Yeah. That lion's like, I'm not scared of you. And then he just walks up and he's like, yes, you are.
Yeah, that's good.
Fucking
that
hell.
That was really good.
Yeah. Oh, boy. But yeah, great, great film.
What are we doing next week?
Next week, we're coming back for the hotly anticipated rescheduled interview with New York Times bestselling author Scott Sigler, talking about Slither and tying that into his Infected trilogy of books.
Mm-hmm.
And, as we say here at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys. Bye.
He's just a criminal who murders people. Be careful how you speak to me, boy. I thought I could change my name. Start a new life. But I could never escape his shadow.
My son, you can't run from your past.
Is this what you wanted?